From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nnamdi Show. Later in the broadcast, from a rural outpost to a high-tech corridor, the transformation of Tyson's Corner into a center for innovation. But first, how one elite athlete is challenging our definitions of disability. 21-year-old Oscar Pistorius had both his legs amputated below the knee when he was an infant. That hasn't stopped him from becoming one of the fastest runners in the world, using high-tech prosthetics to compete. Earlier this year, the world's governing body for track and field decided to ban Pistorius from competing in the Olympics on the grounds that his prosthetics gave him an advantage over able-bodied athletes. On Friday, an international court overturned that decision, meaning that Pistorius could compete in Beijing if he qualifies. In the meantime, his case is stoking discussions about the meaning of disability and the nature of fair play. Joining us to have that discussion by telephone from New York is Alan Schwartz, who is a reporter with the New York Times. Alan Schwartz, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And joining us by telephone from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, is Dr. Bob Gailey, who's a professor of physical therapy at the University of Miami School of Medicine. Bob Gailey, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Kojo.
Alan, allow me to start with you. Oscar Pistorius competes using prosthetics known as cheetahs, which resemble blades. How fast a runner is he, and how close is he to qualifying for the Olympics?
Well, he's extraordinarily fast. He's considerably faster than anyone doing this interview right now, and probably anybody listening. He's one of the fastest human beings on Earth. However, he is not quite fast enough yet to qualify for the Olympics. He needs to run the 400 meters in another second less than he has so far been able to run. He needs to run it in 45 seconds, 45.55 seconds. His current personal best is 46.33, so he needs to chop off about 0.78 of a second, which is, in this world, a lot.
Yep.
And he needs to work very hard before July 20th, which is the cutoff date.
Alan, the track and field governing body decided earlier this year to ban Pistorius from competing in the Olympic based on several days of testing that it did on him. What did that testing involve?
Well, it was very high-tech stuff, where you have video cameras taking a look at and measuring the amount of force. Well, of course, cameras don't measure force, but there were various devices attached to Pistorius. He, of course, volunteered to do this in an effort to be cleared. There were devices used to measure forces imparted and then withdrawn from the ground, and various ways to decide how do his prosthetics work differently, assuming that they do, from a human ankle. How much, and of course, the fellow who is on the line now can do a better job than I can of explaining the details of it, but it was theoretically an effort to determine, does he run faster with less effort than a so-called able-bodied athlete? They decided that he did. However, the higher court resoundingly said that they had not done a good job in determining it one way or the other, and so absent of actual proof that it was an advantage, they cleared him to run.
Indeed, the initial decision banning him competing said that he was able to keep up with a few able-bodied sprinters while expending about 25% less energy. Of course, that decision has now been reversed. Bob Gilley, you've worked with amputee athletes over the years. How would you compare running on a prosthetic to running on a leg?
Well, it's totally different and requires considerably more effort. And just to clarify, one of the issues is that he did expend 25% less energy, but that was only for a 20% portion of the race where he was more efficient. What they ignored was where he had to put in a greater amount of effort, and that's why the ruling came against the AAF, is that they felt that they hadn't done a good job on describing the whole event. The key is that they found with the able-bodied runners in the first two quarters of the race is that they performed better than they did in the second 2/4 of the race. But what they found with Oscar is that he performed in the 2nd and 3rd quarters of the race, and they couldn't explain that third quarter. But what they failed to recognize was that coming out of the blocks, getting up to speed, and turning that corner, he's terribly inefficient. But then as he was able to bring himself up to a level that he could compete equally with the other athletes, then he was able to be able to perform at a level that an Olympic athlete should compete at.
What accounts for that inefficiency coming out of the block, Bob Gailey?
Well, when our sprinter comes out of the blocks, they push off with their feet like you would press on the accelerator of a car. And he doesn't have that capability. Secondly, is that his feet only a very small amount, because they're like blades and they're kind of like bent downwards, a small amount touches the ground. So where other athletes for the first 50 meters stay very low to cut down the wind resistance and build up their speed, he has to come straight up. When they enter that turn in the 400 meters right away, other athletes are pushing off their outside or their right leg. He's just trying to remain upright so that he doesn't slip, and so that when he gets out of the turn, now he can actually hit full stride and be able to take advantage of his athletic ability.
Alan Schwartz, your colleague George Vesey, writing in the New York Times today, said that the decision by the court, according to the Court of Arbitration, quoting here, fell short of the high standards that the international sporting community is entitled to expect. He goes on to say what this decision unbanning Oscar Pistorius essentially means is that if you think the cheaters are an unfair advantage, then prove it. Would you characterize it that way?
Well, it's not my place to characterize it one way or the other. George is a columnist,
true,
whereas I am a reporter. But I think that what was unequivocal, okay, in the court that cleared Mr. Pistorius was that it was very easy to see that the point that they were making was that the lower court, the IAAF, had not proven that these prosthetics are an advantage, and absent that proof, he should be allowed to run. However, the opinion fell all over itself, repeating that this has no application to any other athlete and any other prosthetic. They were not making any sort of a decision about prosthetics or amputees in general. It was merely that in Mr. Pistorius's case, the IAAF had not proven its case. So this was more a situation where, you know, the Supreme Court pretty much threw out a case based on prosecutorial misconduct than actually ruling on the merits of the case. It was more slapping the hand of the lower court than it was truly making a decision that would forever reverberate throughout the sports world.
Alan Schwartz is a reporter for the New York Times. He joins us by telephone from New York. Dr. Bob Gailey is a professor of physical therapy at the University of Miami School of Medicine. He joins us by phone from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. If you'd like to join the conversation, is there a limit in your view to the kinds of technology that should be allowed in elite competition? And if so, what do you think those limits should be? The number is 800-433-8850, or you can send email to Kojo, K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org. What role do you think amputee athletes should play at the Olympics and other high-level competitions? Call and email us now. Bob Gailey, to an outsider, it seems that there are still some unanswered questions about prosthetics, and that, of course, was implied in the court ruling itself. Are there any questions that you have when it comes to the science on this issue?
Oh, absolutely. I think that what's unique is when we study able-bodied athletes is there's literally hundreds of elite-level athletes, so we can gain a lot of information and make some broad and sweeping judgments. However, is that Oscar stands really alone, is that he's the first athlete who wears two prostheses that has kind of broken that barrier and actually even entertain the idea of competing. So we're comparing Oscar to Oscar. How the legs behave, what strategies his body's developed to utilize those have yet to be answered. And I think that what the higher courts are looking at is that, and as was said by Mr. Schwartz, is that absolutely is that there was a hand-slapping that took place. But I think that it is a victory for people with disabilities is because Now, at least it opens the door. It allows Oscar to be able to train. And I think that they're not looking for an advantage. What they're looking for is to be able to compete on an equal playing field, and that they don't want prostheses that make them better. They just want them so that they can compete, because Oscar grew up like any other child. He had role models. He wanted to be an athlete. He wanted to compete. And for him, this is reaching the pinnacle of his sport. And all he wanted to do was to be able to compete.
Interestingly enough, Alan Short, as you pointed out, this decision applies only to Oscar Pistorius, but we just heard Bob Gailey talk about how other amputees are likely to regard it. You've talked with Pistorius himself. How does he characterize it? As a victory for him, or he sees it as a victory for amputees in general?
Well, he did say in the newspaper on Saturday, he said, "It's not just about me, it's about the extra opportunity for amputee athletes," unquote. However, I think that in general, it appears to me from speaking with amputee athletes and other officials across the world that this will not apply directly, or not necessarily apply, it will not affect directly very many athletes, because so few are able to compete on an Olympic level like Mr. Pistorius. The effect that this could have would be if Mr. Pistorius does qualify to run in the Olympics, either this year in Beijing or perhaps London in 2012.
He is, after all, only 21 years old, correct?
Exactly, exactly. If he is able to do that, the media attention that will be showered upon him from all over the world will reach other amputee athletes and essentially all but encourage them to try to do the same thing, or at least advertise to people with disabilities that they can get up and run. Perhaps they can't run in the Olympics or the Paralympics or even their local track meet, but it might encourage them to consider athletics as an option in a way that the lack of mainstream images today keeps that message hidden. So the message of him competing will be more symbolic, I think, than anything particularly demonstrative with the application to thousands of other amputee athletes who want to run in the Olympics. That's not going to happen.
But Alan Schwartz and Bob Gailey, is not the other side of that coin that once, if Oscar competes in the Olympic and gets that much attention, while it may inspire other amputees, won't we see a rising resentment from some of these so-called able-bodied athletes who will be participating? First you, Alan.
Well, I can't say one way or the other. We haven't heard, and I don't think we will. Let's just say my phone has not exactly been ringing off the hook with able-bodied athletes wanting to come out and criticize this fellow for competing. I mean, it's not a very...
Nobody wants to seem that mean-spirited at this point.
Exactly. And to be fair, I mean, the objection would need to be based upon a contention that this is an advantage. Well, I think the response to that is it an advantage? And right now, the best attempt to answer that question has fallen short. And so it would be, you know, at least in the United States, we have a system where you're innocent until proven guilty. And no one has proven that Mr. Pistorius is guilty of having attached an advantage to his body, or at least achieved an advantage through what he attaches to his body. Is it a fair question? Of course it's a fair question, and it's not a mean-spirited question to ask. But pending a sufficient answer, the highest court in sport has said he can run.
Bob Gailey?
Yeah, and I think that there was an athlete by the name of Danny Andrews who was a single-limb amputee. He actually competed at the University of Miami, and it was he actually motivated the other track athletes. It's when you see a young man come out who's using a prosthesis, it really, I think, motivated the other athletes to be able to compete at his level, and there seemed to be more camaraderie, and I think there's more admiration from the able-bodied athletes, is that I think many who do participate in the sport recognize that there's a lot that goes behind having to wear a prosthesis. When he has to pull that leg off, and at the end of an hour session, his limb is bleeding, he has blisters, because it's not just the feet, but it's what happens inside the socket, or that part which surrounds his leg, and his skin. And what people don't recognize, I think, unless shown, is that Oscar each day has to put these limbs on. He has to have the right number of socks. He has to take care of his skin. And there's many days where he has to go out and he can't train because of the other obstacles he has to overcome. So athletes who get close to these, and most of the amputee athletes in our country compete in able-bodied sports. And it's Oscar who has actually turned in the times that brought him to the forefront. The other athletes haven't had the times to put them in this position. But they're athletes, and athletes develop a lot of camaraderie. And I think that there are people who do not mind competing against them. And I think that the better athlete just wants to compete against the best of the best. So the neat thing about having Oscar is that in the United States, as well as around the world, is that our elite athletes have been competing for about 12 years. We have not seen junior athletes coming out and participating, and that there's really been a real dearth of young disabled athletes who want to compete. And hopefully from the notoriety and the conversations that are taking place surrounding Oscar is we will see a new generation of athletes with disabilities wanting to compete in a variety of sports.
Let's go to Jay, who is on 495 in Alexandria, Virginia. Jay, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Kojo. I think a lot of points are being missed here. We're at the beginning of a technological curve, which will ultimately produce chips embedded in the body, other electromechanical devices. What's going to happen when we reach the point where the golfer with the mechanical eye, a la the $6 million man, can use it as a rangefinder to detect exact distances to the pin? Are we going to now have to set up an entire court of arbitration and sport to determine whether or not electromechanical devices do or do not add an advantage? To me, it's not a legal issue. It's an ethical issue. No fault of the athletes. Simply draw a line. Anything that's added to the body that's not natural competes in a separate category.
What about sneakers, sir?
I'm sorry?
What about sneakers? Those are attached to the body.
They're an article of clothing.
Okay. Oh, they're extraordinarily mechanical these days.
I'm sorry?
Those are devices in which the friction between the foot and the ground is monitored and measured and tweaked within microscopic levels. Those things are just as engineered sometimes as some of the devices that people are getting more concerned about today. Sneakers are the way in which the foot interacts with the ground. And it's a little hard, where we draw that line. Believe me, sneakers are on that continuum. They're on one end, perhaps, but I think they're closer to what you're talking about than you've perhaps considered.
They're minor because they don't offer an advantage one athlete to another.
How do you know?
I'm sorry?
How do you know? Have you studied it? That's the issue.
No.
Those who have studied this issue say that Mr. Pistorius' sneakers do not present a technical advantage.
It's very interesting because it indicates the murkiness of the issue that we are dealing with here, does it not, Bob Galey?
Yeah, and I think that that's what the IIIF was really concerned about, is that, and I don't think anyone really wants to see a performance enhancement, but they want to find that there's equality, and that the idea was is once you allow the prosthetic feet, where do you draw the line? And then folks asked about wheels, and one of the determinations is that the human foot is a spring, and that it behaves no differently than the prosthetic foot, and that came out in the ruling, and so that there was no clear advantage, as if you had a wheel or if you had something that possibly was a bionic foot that would be power enhancement. So currently, since it behaves and it has some of the same characteristics as the human foot, in fact, it has had a slight deficit, is that the human foot has muscle, which can add on to the energy that is absorbed and returned, whereas the prosthetic foot can only absorb and return the energy within that material. And there's it gives you about 90% energy return, the human foot 240% energy return. So it's not a performance enhancement.
Okay.
Are they afraid of that? Yes. should that be allowed? No. But, you know, the same thing can be said with LASIK surgery because of...
Sure, we discussed that on this broadcast just about a week ago. Let's go to Tim in Annapolis, Maryland. Tim, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Kojo.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, it's Jim, actually. Sorry about that.
Oh, I'm sorry, too. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, the gentleman in question is what we call a BKA, a below-the-knee amputee. And I'm an above-the-knee amputee. And I think it's admirable that they are going to allow him to race. The only problem I have is that if it comes out to be a big controversy, how will this would adversely affect us who are a disabled community? And down the road, people will look at me and say, well, the guy was in the Olympics and he won the race, and why should we give you special treatment?
Well, let me ask you this, sir. And I'm serious, I don't know the answer to this. What was the effect on the disabled community through your eyes of the Casey Martin case, the golfer who claimed that he needed a cart in order to compete because of a leg condition? And there was certainly a lot of controversy up and through the Supreme Court case where people questioned whether that was fair or not. Did that have a positive effect on the disabled community because of the issues that were raised, or did it have a negative effect because of some of the resentment that was afforded Mr. Martin?
Well, I think the cart is a separate issue because it's not involved in him actually swinging the golf club, okay? And allowing him to have the cart, I don't think adversely affected us or the game itself. But in this case, the actual prosthesis is the main item. I mean, you're going to win the race because of the fact that you're running on prostheses. And you think,
Jim, that if the effect of Oscar Pistorius competing at that level involves having people like you being considered as no longer having a disability, you would see that as a disadvantage to your life?
Well, I think that might be sort of the backlash. I don't know. It might be one of the backlashes that comes out of this is that people will start to view disabled people like me, for instance, why are we giving you special treatment? Why do we have a handicapped parking spot?
I don't
why
think
can't
that,
you walk
first of
all the way across the parking lot.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing is that he's not going to win the race because of the prostheses. He's going to win the race because he trained hard and he's an elite athlete. And that I think that people will still recognize is that there are folks who are different ages and different levels of disability will need assistance. But I think that the biggest push from the ADA and others is the idea is that people with disabilities are equal. They just need special assistance. He is equal to the elite athletes. He just needs the assistance of different types of feet, and I like the analogy of his sneakers are a little bit different. So it's not saying that it puts you in a light that you can do everything. It's just that you are capable of doing things, but yet you may need additional assistance.
Well, I think what this listener is bringing up is a very important point, which is that the call to not treat disabled athletes differently than other athletes has another side, which is that the disabled also ask in other arenas for special dispensations, for ramps to public buildings and whatnot. And needless to say, the law requires and encourages us to do that both publicly and privately. But it is a bit of a contradiction to say on one hand, treat us exactly the same, we're the same as you, and yet on the other hand, ask for some special accommodations. There is something in between that can accommodate both, but it is an inherent contradiction that requires extra probing.
Indeed, and I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. Alan Schwartz is a reporter for the New York Times who is waiting for that sneaker that will allow him to run the 400 meters in 46:33. Won't be happening anytime soon, Alan. I'm sorry.
No, I have my calls into Nike, though.
Dr. Bob Gailey, who is also hoping to run 46:33, is a
Absolutely.
Professor of physical therapy at the University of Miami School of Medicine. Bob Gailey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
Alan, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, what technology had to do with Tyson's Corner being created as we know it today. I'm Kojo Nande. Hi, this is Coach Onandi. My producers and I are dedicated to connecting our neighborhoods with the world. By using email and call-ins, we've always set a place at the table for our listeners. Now, WAMU 88.5 is moving our conversations forward at conversation.wamu.org. Our new social network lets you suggest story ideas for the Coach Onandi show and engage in provocative discussions with other public radio listeners. More information is at conversation.wamu.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Janine Herbst. This is WAMU 88.5. 56 degrees in Northwest Washington under cloudy skies. We're going to a high today in the mid-60s.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Empower Greater D.C. Region and Accenture, honoring local nonprofits with the 2008 Technology Innovation Award. Two nonprofits will receive software and consulting packages. Applications online at empowergdcr.org. From CDWG, with thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the Association of American Railroads, today's freight railroads are committed to working hard for the environment by moving a ton of freight 436 miles on just 1 gallon of fuel. More online at freightrailworks.org.
Today, Tyson's Corner is a mini metropolis, high-end shopping centers next door to high-tech firms, condos side-by-side with defense contractors, and yes, at most times of day, traffic. Few would imagine that less than half a century ago, it was dairy farms and gravel pits. So, how did Tyson's go from there to here? Mostly tech-savvy entrepreneurs took advantage of open land, cheap rents, and government contracting opportunities to transform Tyson's Corner into a hub of scientific and technological development. Maybe that's why, 7 years ago this week, when Apple decided to open its first retail store in America, it chose Tyson's Corner. As battles over traffic and development in Tyson's continue to rage, we thought it was worth looking at the neighborhood's history, and joining us to do so is Paul Ceruzzi, who is a historian and the curator of aerospace electronics and computing at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. His latest book is called Internet Alley, High Technology in Tyson's Corner, 1945 to 2005. Paul, good to see you again.
Yes, I'm glad to be here, Kojo.
A mystery of sorts first drew you into digging into the history of Tyson's Corner. You and many in the ham radio community knew that back in the day, high-frequency radio transmissions were being broadcast in Tyson's and no one knew the reason. Please take us back to that time and tell us what it all had to do with a tower.
Well, during the height of the Cold War, you could hear on the ham radio bands these mysterious random numbers, and everyone speculated about what they were, but no one knew for sure. I subscribed to a newsletter which said one day that the numbers were emanating from a tower in Tyson's Corner, Virginia, and I had never heard of the place at the time. And then the very next newsletter said, never mind, it's not coming from Tyson's Corner. Well, of course, that just put the hair on my neck up because, oh my goodness, an official denial. And that always stuck in my head. And if you go to Tyson's Corner, at the very center is a radio tower with a very strict sign says, do not photograph government property. And we still don't really know exactly what goes on, but I did manage to find some interesting things in the National Archives about the transmissions that come out of the tower.
So even though the numbers weren't coming from the tower had an interesting backstory anyway.
Yes, it does. It was came from the very early days of the Cold War after the Berlin Crisis of 1948, where it was decided to provide a place for the president to relocate in the event of a nuclear war. And a site was chosen in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and a tower was built to relay radio communications from the Pentagon to the Blue Ridge Mountains. And Tyson's Corner was chosen because it's a high spot in Virginia. And coincidentally, it was a place where a signal tower was erected during the Civil War for almost the exact same purpose.
What purpose does the tower serve today?
Well, we don't know. we do know that these sites in the Blue Ridge were pretty much dormant, but then after September 11th, they were reactivated. So they're still in use. And I also noticed, and a lot of people, I'm on a member of an internet discussion group, noticed that there's a new radar dome that was erected on top of the tower. and there's a fresh coat of paint, so there's something going on there.
If you drive past that tower every single day and you want to know what the mystery of it is, well, we can't exactly solve it for you, but we can tell you a little bit both about the tower's history and about the history of what you know today as Tyson's Corner. So if you've got comments or questions, you can call us at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Tyson's Corner wasn't named for Cicely Tyson or Mike Tyson or the chicken folks. Who was it that lent his or her name to Tyson's Corner?
It was a Maryland farmer around the Civil War time who owned land there, and he moved away before any of this happened. So the name stuck. It was originally called Peach Grove, and old maps call it Peach Grove.
So it was what, Tyson's farm at some point?
It was a farm that he owned, yes. It was all farmland up until right up into the 1950s. The suburbs of Fairfax County was a major dairy farming supplier of dairy products to the Washington region.
Peach Grove, it was also called, and one reason Peach Grove became the place for defense technology is apparently largely due to government investment in scientific research during and after World War II. Tell us about that.
Well, during World War II, the government recognized the value of scientific research, but they couldn't really ramp up government laboratories quickly enough, and they came up with a notion of contracting research out to universities primarily in those days. But the notion of contracting took hold. After the war ended, the military recognized a need to keep that kind of technical expertise close by, and they established entities called like the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, but they also felt a need for these entities to be a little bit closer to Washington. Initially, they grew up around the Pentagon in Arlington, but then they moved to Tyson's, taking advantage of open land and cheap rent.
We're talking with Paul Ceruzzi. He's a historian and the curator of aerospace electronics and computing at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. His latest book is called Internet Alley, High Technology in Tyson's Corner, 1945 to 2005. And we're inviting your phone calls about the history of Tyson's Corner, 800-433-8850. It's interesting that you mentioned that up to that point, the government had most of its scientific research done by universities, because once the contract of contractors came in to play, we got a new phenomenon, and that is companies doing contract work for the government on a for-profit basis. In the 1960s, one of the first major players in defense technology was Braddock Dunn McDonald. BDM was apparently criticized right off the bat for doing contract work on a for-profit basis. Today, that seems almost normal to us, those of us who live surrounded by lobbyists.
Yes, it does. And people have been really taking a lot of notice about this, especially with the war in Iraq, about how much work is done by private contractors. Since September 11, 2001, the Pentagon has pretty much doubled the number of private contractors it does work with, while the numbers of federal workers at the Defense Department has remained about the same. So if you live in the Washington area, you're very much aware of this. It was a new phenomenon in the 1960s.
Who knew?
Well, it was obviously the people who founded these companies saw a gap there, what they perceived as a failure. I think one of the events was the failure, the criticism that the RAND Corporation had after one of its members, Daniel Ellsberg, leaked papers to the New York Times, the Pentagon papers.
Yep.
These private companies said, that would never happen with us. None of our employees would ever dare do that because we'd fire them in an instant, and they know that. And they've been pretty good about security.
Nevertheless, as you pointed out, they came in for a lot of criticism, and in the 1970s that I can remember, they used to be known as Beltway Bandits. President Carter didn't particularly like them either.
Well, yes, and that term, I try to avoid using that term referring to the companies, although I did research the history of that term, which came from the opening of the Beltway in 1964, where thieves would break into houses. There were no noise barriers in those days. They'd break into houses from the back door, take the loot, and escape across a state line. And the local police jurisdictions never had any communication from Maryland to Virginia because they were an hour apart in those days before the Beltway. So they could escape, and the newspapers, they got caught. They called them Beltway Bandits. So I talk about that, but I try to avoid using that term referring to the companies.
Sorry, I had to bring it up again, because
no.
Somebody else will probably coin it during the course of the next few weeks.
You'll
see it in a newspaper column someplace. How many of the original companies that started out in the 1960s survived? the turbulence and still exist today?
Well, you know, it changes from day to day. I think CACI or CACI is still around. That was founded as an offshoot of the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica. SAIC, which is a huge employer in Northern Virginia, they're still around. They were founded in San Diego, but their headquarters is in San Diego, but they have more employees here than anywhere else, I think. But all the others have been pretty much gobbled up by Northrop Grumman, which is the largest private employer in the region, Computer Sciences Corporation and Lockheed Martin. They've just pretty much gobbled up these guys, so there's really very few left that are independent.
Well, you mentioned the tower and the do not photograph signs earlier. Someone driving around Tyson's in those days would have seen a lot of buildings, not only with unfamiliar company names, some of them had no names at all, and a lot of signs banning photography. What was going on in those buildings?
Well, there were offices of the intelligence agencies, and they're still around to this day, and you really don't want to go get too close to them with a camera, and there's all kinds of photo reconnaissance work that's done. The Central Intelligence Agency, of course, has its headquarters in Langley, which is just down the road from Tyson's, but they have offices there, and lots of other things related to national security. In recent years, that was sort of overlaid by internet companies, which are secure because they don't want to give away trade secrets. So you have a little bit of both there.
We're going to take a short break. If you've already called, please stay on the line. We will get to your call. We still have a couple of lines open. If you're interested in the history of Tyson's Corner and the role technology played in it, you can call us. It's Tech Tuesday, 800-433-8850, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi.
You're listening to WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon. I'm Janine Herbst. 56 degrees in northwest Washington under cloudy skies. We're going to a high today in the mid-60s with a good chance of rain.
Next time on Tell Me More, the new leader of the NAACP, Ben Jealous, joins host Michelle Martin to talk about his vision for the civil rights organization.
It's been a heck of 100 years for this country because the work that was started by this group in 1909, there's a lot more to be done. And we need to let the world know what we plan to accomplish between 2009 and 2109.
Join Michelle Martin and Ben Jealous next time on Tell Me More.
Today at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the German Embassy and the German Information Center, now celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Berlin Airlift. In 1948, the airlift created a legacy of friendship. More information is at germany.info. From CDWG, with thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From Hodgson Consulting, an Ektron Gold partner, providing content management solutions for clients' web-based initiatives. Hodgson Consulting, fueled by technology, powered by people. On the web at HodgsonConsult.com.
Welcome back. We're discussing the history of Tyson's Corner, and it's Tech Tuesday, so we're focusing specifically on the role of technology in Tyson's Corner as we know it today. Before I get to the telephones, have to get this question out. If somebody were to ask, where is the birthplace of the Internet, it's a good bet that few people would say Tyson's Corner. But it's true. Tell us about ARPA, the government's Advanced Research Project Agency.
Well, that agency was founded in 1958 after Sputnik to just guarantee that the United States would never be surprised that way again. And they let out contracts for computer networking, which became something called the ARPANET. And it was the engineering was done in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and in California, but the management was first done at the Pentagon and then at a place called 1400 Wilson Boulevard, a building which is still there in Rosslyn, Virginia. And then it moved, the management moved out to Tyson's and Reston and Sterling, so all along the Dulles Corridor. That's the place where the Internet was and is conceived and managed, even if the engineering may have been done someplace else.
Okay, now we can go to the telephones. Here now is Kevin in Hamilton, Virginia. Kevin, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, my question concerns Marcus Bless, who was a big landowner in Tyson's Corner. And I'd heard a story that he was a contractor with the Pentagon and had heard about the Beltway going in through Tyson's. They put the perimeter of the Beltway, what they thought would be outside the blast range of an A-bomb, and that he had bought a bunch of land in Tyson's and then developed it over the years. Is there anything like that in the book?
Well, yes. The Beltway was, in fact, laid out to be beyond the reach of an atomic blast. Of course, as soon as the Soviets developed hydrogen bombs, that became a moot point. But, yes, in fact, if you look at the history of the highways, there were many Beltways planned, and the only one that ever got built all the way around was the one that's called the Beltway, which was the first one outside that blast range. Bless owned a farm which was bisected by the Beltway. And developers approached him to buy the farm, and rather than sell it, he agreed to go into a partnership with them and made a lot of money, obviously.
And, Kevin, here's a little more from the personal side of Marcus Bless. We got an email from Judy who says, I was a kid in the early 1950s and went to St. James School in Falls Church. My classmate and sometime boyfriend was Jimmy Bless. Jimmy's dad, Marcus Bless, owned much of the land that is now Tyson's. We used to swim in his pool in front of his mansion, at least I thought it was a mansion, on the hill where the National Association of Automobile Dealers now stands. As I recall it, when the Bless land was sold, it was the largest dollar land transaction then recorded in Northern Virginia.
Yes, there's a lot of truth to that. The Tyson's land was owned by a small number of owners. Bless and Ufelders were the other big landowners. And they were very enlightened in a sense that they recognized that given the growth of the federal government after World War II, that growth was inevitable. And they were right in a very unique location, given the highways and other amenities that they could benefit from it.
Judy, thank you very much for your email. Kevin, thank you for your call. Here's Elaine in Vienna, Virginia. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. Yes, I have a comment and maybe a question. I think it's very short-sighted for the government to not to go ahead and fund having the tunnel go underground as we're building infrastructure. It's not just a short-term solution. Do you have any comment on that or any idea that they might change their mind?
Well, I finished the book before the tunnel controversy erupted, but I do mention how the land was set aside in the Dulles Access Road right from the beginning in 1962 for mass transit. But in 1962, and this is very important, there was really no Tyson's Corner. They thought of a Dulles Access mass transit link going right into Washington, D.C. And what's happened since then, of course, is that any mass transit out to Dulles, which I think everyone agrees we need, would have to somehow make a detour through Tyson's Corner, which is somehow serving two masters. You've got to get people out to the airport quickly, but you also want to make local stops. If you don't have a lot of local stops in Tyson's, that won't do any good because you can get off on Route 7 and you can't cross the street because of the traffic. So you've got to have another stop on the other side. So it's a conundrum. I don't really have an answer except that I say that there ought to be some kind of high technology solution, what I call personal rapid transit or something that would somehow solve this conundrum, which can't be solved by a simple extension of the metro.
Unless, of course, Elaine, you have a solution of your own.
I wish I did.
Okay. Elaine, thank you very much for your call. You
okay,
too can
you.
Call us 800-433-8850. Were you an early resident or worker in Tyson's Corner? You can share your memory with us and talk about what you hope for in the future. 800-433-8850. Here's CJ in Tyson's Corner. Hi, CJ. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo. Yeah, just sort of an interesting factoid was as a young kid growing up in the Tyson's area, what is now we understand to be Tyson's 2 used to be quite a large forest area. And I remember growing up in that area, again, doing a lot of things that kids do at that age when wandering around through woods and motorcycles and the like. But one thing the gentleman that you're with failed to mention company-wise that had a very large presence in that area was the MITRE Corporation, which was one of those, nonprofit type companies.
Indeed. He mentions it, however, in the book. It's called Internet Alley, High Technology in Tyson's Corner, 1945 to 2005. But he will also mention it now. Go ahead, please.
Yes, MITRE is this one of these companies. And if you're in the D.C. area, you know this acronym, FFRDC, Federally Funded Research and Development Center. If you're outside of D.C., you probably never heard of it. But what it is, it's a federally funded entity that they established to get around the civil service rules about salaries and hiring and firing. And there are a few of them around, but the MITRE was not for profit. And I do talk a little bit about this, but I have a feeling that for people outside of the D.C. area, this sounds all very arcane.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. CJ, we got an email from Charles who says, I believe that the white ball on top of the tower is WRC-TV's Doppler radar dome. I don't know. Can you verify that, Paul Cerusi?
Well, no, I can't. I've heard that it was a radar to detect intrusions into the local airspace. I've even heard people say that, indeed, the numbers transmissions are still going out of there, but I have no way of verifying that. And
I don't know how it affects Charles's credibility one way or the other, but he does happen to work for the MITRE Corporation in Tyson.
Well, there you go.
So he might know. We're talking with Paul Cerusi. He's a historian and the curator of aerospace electronics and computing at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. We're talking about his latest book. It's called Internet Alley, High Technology in Tyson's Corner, 1945 to 2005. It's a Tech Tuesday conversation. Let's bring Gary in Sterling, Virginia into it. Gary, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I believe the only way for the Dulles Corridor problem to be solved is through the use of satellite and computer technology to analyze, prioritize, and design. In fact, I would go further. One of the things about Tyson's Corner and the reason they couldn't put the subway underground is because they have an underground city down there and they don't want people, and it would disturb it. So
we get back to the Cold War and the ham radio operators hearing numbers coming from the tower and what might be underneath Tyson's Corner. Well, Paul Cerusi, what do we know?
Well, I can tell you what I do know is underneath Tyson's Corner is a big chunk of the world's internet traffic. It's run in fiber optic cables, very thin, in conduits underneath the main streets, the Dulles Corridor. And if you do decide to dig a tunnel under there, which might be a great idea, but you've got to somehow make sure you don't cut these cables, because I don't know the exact percentage. At one time, something like 50% of the world's internet traffic went through Tyson's Corner. I think it's a lot less now, but still quite a bit.
Now that the internet and personal computing are ubiquitous, we get concerned when we hear about anything that might disrupt our internet traffic. But how did a clandestine defense contracting opportunity lead to today's ubiquitous technology world?
Well, you know, part of it was sort of technology on the march, but part of it was due to the vision of two gentlemen who still live and work in the Dulles Corridor, Robert Kahn and Vinton Cerf. Kahn was
Cerf we've had on the broadcast quite a few occasions.
Yes, he's now an executive with Google, and they developed the protocols of the modern internet, the so-called TCP/IP. And they both live and work in the area, and they were evangelists at a time when people didn't know what this was, or they thought they were supporting another protocol called OSI, I think it was the name. Anyway, they were evangelists, and they pushed it as hard as they could. And I think they recognized that it had to get out of this government sponsorship and into the commercial world, and they really, Vince Cerf, especially when he worked for MCI, he really sought to commercialize it a lot.
Yeah, we've brought him here on a few occasions to give him a few Tech Tuesday tips, like tie your shoelaces, Vince. Here's Luke in Prince William County. Luke, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was wanting to ask if there had been consideration given to a monorail-type system for the Tyson's Corner route. I'm familiar with the system. It was going to be built there in 1960s like that, and it was abandoned and it never surfaced again.
Paul? I do talk about that. In 1962, there were two monorails built in the, on the West Coast at Disneyland and Seattle for the World's Fair. It was, I believe it was a Swiss firm called Alweg. And I heard, I've never been able to prove this, that they wanted to use the same system to take people from Dulles Airport to Washington. Obviously, it was never built. The land was reserved, and thank God we've got that. We've got the land in the median of the highway, but the monorail wasn't built. And I think it was a mistake, because if it had been built, we'd be using it today.
Okay, thank you very much for your call, Luke. Here's Mike in Laytonsville, Maryland. Hi, Mike. Your turn.
How are you? I'm doing fine. Hey, I did some work in a place called Ashgrove, which was owned by the Sherman family. I heard someone mention something about the forest. And I know that at one time in the 1850s when they bought the property, I believe that one of his relatives was the, I guess, what would now be called the Department of Interior, and had planted quite a few trees in there. And I was just curious about if you knew the status. It was a great collection of outbuildings. I believe it was originally a hunting cabin for Lord Fairfax. And I was curious if you knew anything about Ashgrove.
No, I'm sorry, I don't. If there were any in Tyson's Corner, it's pretty much gone now.
Hey, thank you for your call. Mike, the Strategic Defense Initiative, for those of us who remember President Reagan's Star Wars program, that apparently was born in Tyson's too.
Well, the main contracts were let outside of Tyson's, but a lot of subcontracting went to BDM, which was a company that was essentially founded in El Paso, Texas, to do missile defense based on rockets that were launched from the White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico. And they carried that expertise with them when they moved from Texas to Tyson's, and they continued to be the primary kind of go-to company for research in missile defense.
And even though we're running out of time very quickly, while defense contracting bloomed in the times of the Cold War and Soviet fear, a downturn came with the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's my understanding that there was a kind of last supper of sorts, a dinner in 1993.
That's right. The Deputy Secretary of Defense called a lot of executives in from all the major defense contractors and said, half of you aren't going to be here in a few years, which is not a very good thought, but the implication was that you either combine with one another or you go out of business. And the other implication, which he didn't really have the authority to say, is that if you did, we won't prosecute you for antitrust. But the result of that is Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, and General Dynamics. That's about it today.
Paul Ceruzzi is a historian and the curator of aerospace electronics and computing at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. His latest book is called Internet Alley, High Technology in Tyson's Corner, 1945 to 2005. Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much, Kojo.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
This is WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon. I'm Janine Herbst. 56 degrees, cloudy skies in Northwest Washington. Today's programs are made possible in part by Amy and Dan Clemens in honor of their third wedding anniversary.
Today, the U.S. Attorney for Maryland and other federal officials announced the results of what they say is a major crackdown on telemarketing fraud. I'm Gene Coletta, and we'll have that story later today during All Things Considered on WAMU 88.5.